We just heard Maria BC with a song called Tide. Initially, I kept thinking it was Tired. I kept reading it as Tired. And then I was listening to the lyrics. I was like, huh, she's really talking about like a relationship or something, codependency or something like that. And I realized my own error. That song features Mitsu, the wonderful cellist. It's been on the show before, and that whole album is great. It's called Spike Field, released on Sacred Bones Records. We also heard Chuck Johnson with Moonstone from Balsams, the album, and started that set off with Nala Sinifro. Song is called Space 7 from the wonderful album Space 1.8, released a few years ago on Warp Records. That is it for me, everybody. I'll be here next week, hanging out, playing more music. And till then, have fun. I lost my train of thought again. It's like I thought something would come to me when I said till then, but nothing did. It's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online, WFMU.org. My name's Olivia. It's been Radio Ravioli, here every Monday, 3 to 6. See you later. Bye.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from downtown Jersey City in the great state of New Jersey. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm happy to be here. And all good news to report, all good. We just completed our annual fundraising marathon, this two-week extravaganza here at WFMU. And we made the goal and then some, thanks to you, the listeners. The marathon just ended last night, and it was just the whole two-week experience was great. 2 weeks and, yeah, full 2 weeks. And I just want to say thanks to all the listeners who contributed, who pledged during the marathon. I want to say thanks to the Swag for Life members who continue to donate every month, whether or not you pledge during the marathon. And I also want to say thanks to the listeners and other community members who cooked meals for us and were volunteering in the phone room. There were phone volunteers throughout the 2 weeks taking phone calls. It's a huge team, not just a team effort, it's a community effort to raise the money we need. We raised over $1.6 million, and that's the money we need to keep running the station for another year. And it's because of your generosity that I'm still on the air here. So thank you to everyone who pledged. And for everyone who marked Tectonic as a show to say hello to, and some of you, many of you, wrote nice comments in your pledges. Thank you to you as well. I read every single comment that came in on the pledge form. So it was just a real pleasure. For those of you who caught our finale last night, the Hoof and Mouth Sinfonia, yes, that was a lot of fun. Someone said on the comment board, Mark, I thought your song choice would be a little more tech-inflected. And you get what you get. But it was a lot of fun. So with the marathon done, and we are fully funded now here, thanks to you, we get to continue with our important work. And I'm passionate about this show and just continue to feel so lucky and so privileged to be part of this radio station, part of this community. I'm just so happy to be here. And I'm happy to get back with normal programming starting now. And I'm really happy to present you with an interview I did with Ian Johnson about his new book. It's called Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. Now, at first glance, you might say, what is the tech angle on China's underground historians? And actually, the importance to this show runs throughout this book and throughout the themes of this book. First of all, because we have to be paying attention to what's happening in China. I mean, just for starters, if you look at the news, the tech news in the past few weeks, a lot of it has to do with TikTok, this Chinese-owned social media app, and the question of whether it's going to get a federal ban. If I have some time, and I think I will probably have some time after the interview, I want to give you my thoughts, just a generalist's perspective of what this means and how you may want to think about it, how I'm thinking about it, for whatever that's worth. Because I think there's some nuance in the coverage that might be sometimes getting lost. And so I want to say something about TikTok. And that goes back to China. If we're going to understand the TikTok ban, the likely ban, we have to have some basic understanding of China. And it's not just TikTok. I mean, if you want to understand some of what Elon Musk is doing with Tesla, he's trying to both court the consumers in China for his cars and also fight off competition from Chinese brands. I could go on to all sorts of tech stories that have a reflection from what's happening in China. And as we go forward, with tech news and with this show, I think it's going to become increasingly important that we have some fluency. This is going to come up in the interview. I have covered China on a number of past shows, but I'm happy to return to it every so often to give us a new angle. And so this book, again, it's called Sparks by Ian Johnson. This book covers historians, so-called underground historians, that are not the official historians that have been set up by the Chinese Communist Party, the ruling body of China. These are independent historians who are telling the truth as they see it, that is outside of the official narrative, propaganda narrative that comes down from the CCP. And how are they able to get their history out to readers and viewers outside of China? It's internet technology. It's digital technology. So in a way, there is some good news here about, get ready for it, listeners, a good use of digital technology, even as digital technology at the same time is being used to lock down over a billion people in China with overbearing surveillance and propaganda and all the rest. So it's a fascinating story. I'm going to play this interview, and afterwards, as I said, I hope I'll have some time to talk a little bit about the TikTok ban. There was one other thing I wanted to cover really quick before I get to the interview. Since I was just talking about the marathon, I need to issue a correction very quickly, because once in a while I get something totally wrong and I feel bad, and so I need to correct myself later. In the first marathon show, so this was 2 weeks ago, my co-host was station manager Ken Friedman, and he brought up Weyland Yutani. Actually, I think someone in their pledge comment brought up Weyland Yutani, and Ken asked me, well, what is Weyland Yutani? And I said, that's from Blade Runner. And it was just off the top of my head. I knew it was a sci-fi franchise, and I thought at the moment it was Blade Runner. It was not Blade Runner. Yes, I was wrong. People on the comment board immediately were correcting me nicely. It was Alien. Alien. Weyland Yutani was the conglomerate that set the story of Alien into motion. So sorry I got the sci-fi franchise wrong. Now it's been corrected, and we can move on. If you'd like to join in the live listener chat, you can go to WFMU.org, click playlists and comments, and you can join in the conversation about Sparks, about Chinese underground historians, or how I don't know my sci-fi, whatever you want to talk about. And now let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Ian Johnson, author of Sparks, here on Tectonic on WFMU. Ian Johnson, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. I am excited to talk about your fascinating book, Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. This book is a result of years of research that you did in order to get to know, as you call them, underground historians in China. These are people who live under the dictatorship of Xi Jinping and at great personal risk are documenting events in Chinese history, both past and present, that the Chinese Communist Party would rather keep suppressed. Later in the conversation, we'll get to the role of digital technology in all of this. But first, I thought maybe we could start with an example of one of the historians that you talk about. Actually, you open the book with her. Can you talk about Ai Xiaoming, a documentary filmmaker who has courageously been documenting a number of events from mid-20th century Chinese history?
Yes, Ai Xiaoming is now a 71-year-old retired scholar and filmmaker. She started making films relatively late in her life. She didn't go to film school. She's not a trained filmmaker. So like a lot of the people in my book, they're somewhat autodidactic in that they came into what they were doing sort of by chance and felt a calling. She's a feminist scholar. And in her class in Guangzhou, which is the big metropolis down by Hong Kong, the students staged the Vagina Monologues, and she thought, this is a really interesting play. We should document this. It's the first time that it's been translated into Chinese and been performed in Chinese. So she called up an old friend of hers, this documentary filmmaker, Hu Jie, and she invited him down from Nanjing to film the performance. And Hu Jie, who's probably one of the best known independent filmmaker living inside China now, he brought his equipment and started to film. And, you know, this is the late 1990s, and this is the advent of digital cameras and digital equipment. And she watched him work out, and she thought, you know, I could probably do something like this too. He's editing the stuff on his computer, and she was already a film nut. She had she loved films and had watched hundreds and hundreds of different films, especially when she had a 1 year at the University of the South in Tennessee. She spent her whole time watching films. So she sort of essentially apprenticed with Hu Jie, and they made a few films together. She started out small, making shorter films, half an hour, 45 minutes, and then built up to these epic, ambitious films that we have today that she's made.
Now, we should state why it is so remarkable that someone like Ai Xiaoming has put in this work to make a number of documentary films. Because here in the U.S., if someone, let's say, went to University of the South and then linked up with a fellow American documentary filmmaker, that would be nice, but it wouldn't be all that unusual. But in China, especially given the subject matter that Ai Xiaoming is covering, it is a risky proposition for her to get the footage and edit it into a watchable film and then release it, right? I mean, what are the risks for someone who's doing what she's doing?
Yeah, it is risky because most of the films she's made are not about things like the Vagina Monologues. They're about much more sensitive issues. So she did another film on a farmer uprising in a village nearby where she lived. She did a 4.5 hour documentary on a labor camp in China, probably the most notorious labor camp in China. So making these films are indeed risky. It requires her to work on her own most of the time. She can't work with a team because she has to fund all of this herself. She has no foreign backing because that would open her up to being an agent of overseas subversion or something like that. And she sometimes works with a grad student who helps her lug around equipment, but she basically has to do the whole thing on her own, travel to these different places. And if she's detained, they can confiscate stuff. You know, in China, there's very little, almost no legal protections that people have against search and seizure. So if somebody wants to open up your computer and suck everything off the hard drive, they can do it. And they can then charge you with a variety of so-called crimes, such as picking quarrels or something like that, which are these overall, these very flexible crimes that they can accuse you with. Subversion of state power, that's one. So you're subverting state power by pointing out the weaknesses of the Communist Party or mistakes that it's made. These are all things that you open yourself up for.
You cover a number of underground historians in this book, and they're not all documentary filmmakers. I mean, you mentioned Hu Jie, who also is a documentary filmmaker, but you also cover writers, people like Jiang Xue, who published a magazine briefly called Spark, which is in part where you got the name of the book from, Sparks. This was a magazine that openly criticized the government at the time. This is, again, 1960, and they made it for all of, what was it, 6 months before they were shut down?
Yes, this was what ended up becoming a very famous case, but at the time it seemed like a hopeless and quixotic effort by these students in northwestern China to document the Great Famine from 1958 to 1961, which is probably the greatest trauma that China has been through over the past century. With more than, well, up to 45 million people dying of starvation. The students at the time, they made this on a mimeograph machine, which is a really old piece of technology, and they were all rounded up 40 people were arrested, three of them ultimately executed, including a very famous poet who stayed in jail for over a decade, writing often with her own blood on paper.
This was Lin Zhao?
This is Lin Zhao. Yeah, Lin Zhao is one of the most famous dissidents in the Mao era. She wrote for the magazine Spark also. And this would have disappeared except for the advent of digital technologies, which I guess we'll get to a little bit later. But that's what revived this thing after it had disappeared.
Can you say just a little more about Lin Zhao? Because that's another writer who you cover in the book. And that was such an evocative story of this young woman being locked up in prison, not given any ink in order to write, and then uses her own blood.
Yes, when the communists took power in 1949, she was a believer in the party. She participated in some of the political campaigns they had in the early 1950s, but she ended up going to university and rediscovering her Christian faith, which I think made her question many of the things that the party was promoting. And she also saw the extreme brutality that the party used against its opponents. So when she was locked up, she was held in solitary confinement for over a decade. And at many points in that decade, she was denied ink, and she used her comb. It was a plastic comb, and she broke it and then pricked her finger and used that as like a quill and wrote on parchment or even on her clothes. And in the way that good authoritarian bureaucracies are, the police, the prison wardens didn't want to lose anything. So they carefully collected all this stuff as more evidence by this counter-revolutionary person and kept it all so that it didn't get lost, which, you know, of course might have happened. But she persisted until finally she was executed in 1970.
To me, the idea of someone in prison under an authoritarian government writing dissident poetry and literature with her own blood is such an evocative metaphor for the risks that people like these historians will take in order to tell the truth and to document actual history, again, at great personal risk. The contemporary historians, documentary filmmakers, and writers and journalists who you cover also in the book who are working today, they're not physically writing with their blood, but they do run the risk, as you say, of being drawn up on these charges. Throughout the book, I see you drawing parallels between the Mao era and what has emerged as a new authoritarian era under Xi Jinping. When Xi Jinping became general secretary, and I believe you write this in Sparks, there was some initial optimism that maybe things would loosen up a little bit. But as it turns out, as someone told you, things are locked down right now as much as they ever have been. That makes the work of these historians today that much more important.
Yeah, I think it does. It's a bit of a misperception that everything has been controlled by Xi Jinping. He has made things tighter than ever. Things are darker, bleaker than they have been. But it's important to recognize that there are still Chinese people with other visions of China. There are people who are struggling to write these ideas, to make films about these ideas, and they're still active today in the third decade of the 21st century. So I think we should try to engage with these kinds of people more and understand their viewpoints more and not just sort of give in to the party propaganda, which is that they control everything.
Yeah, this is a point that you made repeatedly throughout the book, which is the work of these historians is worth reading or watching on its own merits, learning about the history that they're describing. But it's also important to pay attention to remind us, as you said, Ian, that China is not one monoculture of people under the full control of the Chinese Communist Party. There is another kind of culture that is alive and maybe we could say well, although it's small, but it's very much alive within China. People who have an independence of spirit and who have a commitment to truth in order to leave behind a lasting legacy for the next generation to understand their country and their culture beyond the propaganda of the communists. I mean, it's actually a very inspiring and heartening message that you're delivering to us, that even in a very bleak time, there are still people who are willing to put themselves at risk and do the important work.
Yeah, I think they are motivated not by necessarily quote-unquote Western ideals or ideas. This is sometimes how these people might be criticized for being stooges of the West or something like that. But actually, they're really motivated by traditional Chinese ideas. And if you, you know, go back into Chinese history, probably history itself is almost like a religion. History is a kind of faith. The belief that the historian's job is to tell the truth, to stand up to authority, even if they have to pay a huge cost. The first great historian, well-known historian in China, Sima Qian, was castrated and still carried on to write the first macro history of China because he felt it was so important. And this is, in a way, the government's conundrum, because the government nowadays is trying to position itself as a defender of Chinese traditions and things like that, similarly to how Vladimir Putin presents himself as a defender of the Orthodox faith. Xi Jinping says, I'm a defender of Chinese tradition, Chinese values, and so on and so forth. But these values, when you get right down to them, the heroes of these stories are the people who stand up to power. They're not the, it's not the emperor who castrated Sima Qian. He's the bad guy, obviously, in the story, right? It's Sima Qian who's the good guy. So when you read all these things, and it goes back to, you know, just when kids are in elementary school and they're reading in their Chinese language textbooks, they get the simplified versions of these stories. It's the person who stands up to authority. You know, the great holidays in China are often about those kinds of things.
There's this term, this Chinese term that you bring up a number of times in the book called Jianghu, which literally means rivers and lakes. That's a term that goes back in Chinese history several hundred years, right? Referring to the people who live on the outskirts, just outside the reach of the empire, thinking independent thoughts and maybe even brewing up rebellion.
Yeah, they could be, in Western terms, they might be thought of as the Robin Hoods in Sherwood Forest, who are nominally outlaws, but they stand for a higher value. They're the true patriots. And this is often the case in Chinese history. It's the people in the Jianghu who have these sworn brotherhoods, or in modern day terms, sisterhoods also, of people who will help each other. And they'll stand up for each other in difficulty. They, I think, represent these kind of traditional Chinese values.
Can I just nerd out here for a second? As you know, Ian, there's four Chinese classic novels. One is Journey to the West, which I read and liked a lot. And another is a book called The Water Margin, which is all about these, I think it was 108 heroes who are living in the rivers and lakes and opposed to the emperor. That fits in with the Jianghu that you're covering in this book, right?
Yes, people refer to themselves in that sense also. And they sometimes mean it in a somewhat self-deprecating sense, that they may be uncouth or they may be a bit rough and ready, but their hearts are in the right place. So they talk about it quite a lot. There's one guy I write about in the book, a Tiger Temple. And he, that's his nom de guerre or whatever, but I remember asking him over and over again, you know, what motivates you? Why are you doing this? Why are you making these films, et cetera? And he said, I don't know all about this theory that you're asking. I only know that when I see something wrong, and he used the Chinese term yi, which is also comes typically, you know, from these novels of righteousness or justice. He says, when I see something that isn't yi, then I have to stand up for it. And so that's something I think that it's a universal human idea, right? That justice, truth, that these are higher values. And you see it in Chinese culture too.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Ian Johnson, author of the book Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. We're hearing about these independent historians, and just now we heard how they fit into the idea of the Jianghu, which you can read about in a lot of Chinese literature, including the Water Margin, also known as Robbers of the Marsh. If you want to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comment. Now let's hear the second half of my interview with Ian Johnson, author of Sparks, here on Tectonic on WFMU. Let's talk a little bit about digital technology, because all of the contemporary historians that we've talked about, whether they are documentary filmmakers or writing long history books, some of the people you cover have written 500, 600-page histories of different parts of Chinese history, or poets, all of them are using digital technology in order to get their creations out to a wider audience, because obviously they can't use traditional publishers. You talked to one of the documentary filmmakers who pointed out how important it was that they took their films digitally, because if they used traditional film, they would need to send the film to a processing plant, a separate company, and the company would probably refuse to process their film because it would show that it's in opposition to the government and the company doesn't want to get in trouble. But with digital technology, people have been able to publish directly without any intermediate steps. Can you say more about the importance of the technology these historians are using?
Yeah, I think the example of the magazine that I mentioned, that my book takes its name from, Spark, I think that's a good example because, as I mentioned, this magazine only existed in 1960 for a short while. Everyone was arrested, executed, et cetera, et cetera. Then in the 1980s, one of the members of Spark, who was released from jail, she got to look into her personnel file, which is a file that the Communist Party has on all kinds of people. Almost like everybody in the country has a personnel file. And in it, she saw all the back copies of Spark. She saw all the confessions, everything related to her case and her friend's cases. So she made photos of that. And again, it just sat in her apartment and nothing happened to it in the 1980s because there was no digital technology. It was only in the late 1990s that some friends of hers said, hey, you know what? We can use a PDF and we can put these things together and we can recreate the magazine that you guys made 40 years earlier. And then we can also put together all the confessions, all the photos, even the love letters that she had written to her boyfriend had been saved. Because again, this obsessive compulsive nature of the bureaucratic state to save everything because you never know what might be useful and who are you as the lowly police officer to throw something away. So they put all this stuff together and it began to circulate. And this is, I would date this to the beginning of this citizen historian, this underground historian movement. It's really the late 1990s when digital technologies hits China, that people begin to make films with digital cameras. They use PDFs to recreate lost or banned books and then to write new stuff themselves. So this is the rise of great independent history journals, some of which are still publishing today, such as Remembrance, which has been going now for more than 15 years, and other publications also.
So what are some of the technologies people are using? You mentioned the PDF file format has been helpful. Digital video cameras, VPNs have been important as well, and USB thumb drives as ways to pass around materials, right?
Yes. Many times when you meet these independent historians, they'll give you something that looks like a credit card, and it'll have a cover of their book on it. And then you push from behind, and a USB thumb drive type connection pops out of it. You stick it into your computer and there's the book there you can download as a PDF. So you can sort of keep these and trade them kind of like baseball cards or something like that. So people hand these things around like that, or just with a thumb drive, here's my film. Let me know what you think of it. Feel free to copy it. People like Hu Jie, for example, I think one of the reasons he's been hard for film festivals to get a handle on is he makes multiple iterations of his films and he posts everything to YouTube to make sure that they're safe, right? So he's got this thing up on YouTube, but it makes it hard to say, well, is that film from 04 or 05? Or was it 2015 or 2016? So it's, you want to introduce him to Cannes, is he going to be part of this year or was it actually made 5 years ago? So he doesn't sort of fit into those things, but they use VPNs. VPN usage in China, it's not widespread, and it's very hard to get an estimate on it. But it's certainly in the millions and millions of people have it. It may just be 1% of the population or 1% of the internet users, but still there are roughly a billion internet users in China. So in raw numbers, it's still significant. And I think people like this function like gatekeepers because they are able to put things up on YouTube or Twitter. There's a guy on Twitter called Teacher Lee. People will send him stuff like these protests that happened recently in China. He puts them onto his account. Other people will follow him from China using VPNs, download the videos, and spread it back inside China. So they use the overseas platforms as clearinghouses for information. And the number of people with VPNs, again, not huge, but that gets it back into China, and then it spreads further like that.
At the end of the book, you have a really helpful list of resources where people can go to view the documentary films and even read some of the books that you mentioned. Is there a site or a resource that would be good for listeners to go as an introduction to some of the work of these historians?
Yes, I just set up last year a registered charity called the China Unofficial Archives. I'll send you the URL and maybe you can put it up in the program notes, but it's got about 800 items on it right now. We have 40 or 50 films, and we are just digitized another 150, 175 films that we're going to put up. So this is an effort to just consolidate all this information in one place so that we can make it more easily accessible. It's sortable by the name of the person. So if you know, oh, Ai Xiaoming did this film, what else has she done? You can look at her other films. It's sortable by theme, the Cultural Revolution or era or format. So if you want to look at books on the Cultural Revolution, you can click books and click Cultural Revolution and it'll sort what we have. It's still a work in progress. We're still reorganizing stuff. We're going to be redoing some of it. We don't have a great database software right now to put it all together, but we're working on it now. It's still fully functional now, but it's not, I think, where it will be in a few months.
So far, as we've talked about digital technology, it's been a positive story, at least for the dissidents. You know, look at the good things that a thumb drive with a PDF will do, or a VPN letting them upload their documentary film to YouTube for general viewing and distribution. There's another side, of course, to digital technology in China, and that is the censorship and the use of surveillance hardware and algorithms in order for the government to try to keep people locked down. Do you see the use of digital technology in China right now more favoring the authoritarian surveillance state or more favoring the independent dissidents?
I think there's no doubt that it favors the government, because the government is essentially the evil empire, like in Star Wars, and the dissidents are maybe like the Republic, or I can't even remember the films. But you know, it's an asymmetrical battle, of course. And there's a Yale professor, James Scott, who wrote this book called Weapons of the Weak, and he talks about ways that underprivileged groups can fight back in various societies. He doesn't talk about digital technologies. He's talking about other ways that people can resist authority. But in some ways, if you use it in this sense, these are kind of weapons of the weak. They're ways of fighting back and trying to keep the flame alive, trying to get things on the record, keep them safe until a more open China might arise in the future. And I think there's mainly a lot of the people working on this are working in the hope that things will change someday in China. And I think that's also something worth keeping in mind. We tend to think of countries as unchanging. We look at a country like China right now, and it looks like an authoritarian monolith, which to some degree it is, but it doesn't mean it will always be like this. And we should keep an open mind about that. By the same token, I think these people want to preserve this information and send it forward to overseas Chinese communities and to future Chinese communities, generations of people who will be looking at this.
What do you think is the message for people living outside China? Beyond the historical subject matter of this book, Sparks, I wonder if there is another message that you're imparting to us about the importance of documenting history, telling the truth, standing up to injustice. What would you like Westerners to take away from the example of these brave historians in China?
I think the key idea would be to resist the fatalism with which we see China. There tends to be, in our political sphere today, only one thing that people agree on, which is that China is completely messed up and we should sort of isolate ourselves from it as much and as quickly as possible. And there's no doubt that China has become more authoritarian, and there are some measures that governments are taking around the world that need to be done in order to keep the U.S. and other countries safe from Chinese government interference. But it's that we should never completely assume we know a country's trajectory. I think Vaclav Havel has a very famous saying that he made in 1986, so it was before the Iron Curtain fell, while things were still pretty bleak in Czechoslovakia. And he said, it's a mistake to think that the face that a country presents itself to the outside world is the only face that it will ever show. We can't tell what potentialities lie in the hearts of people. So I think that we should try to be more willing to engage with China. If we want to engage with China, we should engage with these kinds of people in China. These are the kind of people who should be invited to our think tanks, to our universities. We should have a film festival for Hu Jia, for Ai Xiaoming. It's going to be hard because some of them have travel bans and so on. We should push our publishers to translate more. I think there was a lot more translated in the 70s and 80s on Central and Eastern European authors. I don't know if that's just sort of ethnocentrism or if it reflects profit margins at publishing houses now being razor thin, etc. But we should try to get this stuff better known so that we do realize that there are Solzhenitsyns in China today. There are people like that. They didn't just exist in the Soviet Union. They're active in writing today in China. The Milan Kunderas and Vaclav Havels exist, and they're in China. And we should just try to reach out and talk to those kind of people. I think that would be my message to civil society in the West. You know, don't just like throw up your hands and say, well, it's right off China. We need to go there and study. I think young people should go there and learn the language. You know, I think this is a real tragedy. How few people are going to China right now to learn Chinese and to learn about the country. So I would strongly encourage more engagement with China, not to, you know, whitewash what the government's doing there or anything like that, but simply because we have to push people-to-people ties, I think, as much as possible.
That sounds right to me. And yet, I find it interesting that you're encouraging young people to go study there, because China actually showed you the door a few years ago, didn't they? Weren't you forced to leave along with a bunch of journalists?
Yeah, that was a fairly unique situation. The Trump administration expelled nearly 60 Chinese journalists. And so this tit-for-tat expulsions, then the Chinese turned around and expelled about 15 American journalists. But I mean, there's no doubt, really, though, of course, things are much tighter now. It's not the same place that it was before. But I don't think it's a dangerous place for undergraduates to go and learn Chinese. I mean, you're far more likely to be run over by a car or pickpocketed or mugged. You know, I live in New York City and I see stuff, you know, all the time, than you are to have anything happen in China. It's still a country where people are extremely hospitable. And I think people can go and have a good, positive experience. And, you know, no matter what you think of China, you have to understand this country, which is the second most populous country in the world, second biggest economy in the world. Even just from those sort of realpolitik point of view, the United States needs to send thousands more. We have fewer than 1,000 Americans studying in China right now. And there used to be about 20,000. It's somewhere around 700-800 right now. So this is a disaster in the future. We're going to have a whole generation of people who are China experts in the future who've never been to China. How's that going to work? That's just going to lead to all kinds of problems and mistakes down the road. So we need to restart those things. And, you know, there's a bunch of logistical issues and problems for sure. Airfares are high, et cetera, et cetera. But I think these are short-term solvable issues. We need to mainly want to engage with China and deal with it.
I thought maybe we could end with one last example. We started the interview with the example of Ai Xiaoming, and we talked about a bunch of the historians. I just wanted to acknowledge that you did a good job of mentioning the minority, the ethnic minority experience in China. I've covered the Uyghurs a number of times on this show. I've had Darren Byler on the show and Paul Mosier, and we've had good conversations about the experience in the western region of Xinjiang of that ethnic minority. One of the final people you bring up in the book is a Tibetan writer named Tsering Woser. She is a Tibetan writer living under house arrest in Beijing and is yet another historian who is standing up to injustice, wants to tell the truth about what happened in Tibet, and seems to be an unsinkable spirit, just continues to press forward. Can you say more about Tsering?
Well, probably her most influential book was called Forbidden Memories, which was a book that of photographs that her father left her when he died. Her father had been with the People's Liberation Army. He was Tibetan, but there were minorities who served in the armed forces of China. And she didn't know what they were. She thought they were just maybe holiday photos or things like that. But she noticed the last few years of his life, he'd been obsessively filing and cataloging them and annotating them. So he gave them to her. And a year or two later, she starts looking in them and she sees, oh my goodness, these are pictures of the destruction of Tibet in the Cultural Revolution. And so her father must have had some kind of official position to document this. He was in the army and he had a camera and was allowed to take these pictures because they weren't furtively taken pictures. They were clearly pictures documenting full-scale destruction of things. And they were all annotated. So this provided a rare record of the destruction in Tibet. You mentioned the other minority areas, and I think the problem there is that there's so little archival evidence, and there's so few people who have gone on the record, who have done oral histories, so that we don't know very much about what happened in Tibet. We know there was this vast destruction, but when a temple was destroyed, what day was that? What month was that? When did that actually happen? What did it look like before? And so on. He provides this in his hundreds of photos that he left behind. So she worked with this fellow who became her husband, a Han Chinese named Wang Lixiong, and they published it first in Taiwan, and now they've published it in English. It's a very interesting book. It's very accessible. It's been translated, and it's a real historical document.
Well, Ian, I really appreciate you coming on the show. This story of Tsering Woser is indicative of the fascinating and inspirational profiles that you're giving us throughout the book of writers, filmmakers, poets, and exposing us to the history of China and the reality of China that is not always expressed in the media coverage that we get today. So well worth Tectonic listeners reading this book. It's called Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future by Ian Johnson. Ian, thanks so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Science, seed, swap.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the remaining 12 minutes of the show. And then Dave Manda will come on with his show. It's complicated. It's a prog rock show. And I hope you'll listen to it. And then I hope you'll stay tuned for Amanda and Jim the Poet with Bad Animals. And then brother Daniel Blumen with his eponymous show from 9 p.m. to 12 midnight Eastern. We just heard my interview with Ian Johnson, author of the new book, Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. And so, as I said before the interview, digital technology plays a big part in this story. As you heard, between VPNs and thumb drives and even the surveillance-heavy big tech-owned video site that I usually disparage called YouTube, there apparently is a silver lining in that surveillance hellscape that Google has set up for us, that there are some independent documentaries from Chinese filmmakers that make it onto YouTube and are viewable. Of course, you have to view them under Google's terms and conditions, but they're there, and they made it outside the Great Firewall of China, out from under the noses of the CCP censors. So that's good, at least. On the playlist, you will see that I have placed a link to the China Unofficial Archives. That's Ian's site that he talked about that has, I think he said, there's 800 resources to documentaries and books and articles and so on by these underground historians. You can find it there at WFMU.org. By the way, if you're listening to the show in the future, you can find that playlist and these links to the book and to the archives at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the March 18, 2024 show, and the playlist link will be there. You can also read the comments from the listeners this evening. So I appreciate Ian Johnson taking some time to speak with us, and hope you'll dive in, because as I said before the interview, it's important that we get to know what's happening in China, because it reflects and refracts and eventually affects all of us. And that brings me to TikTok. I have a few minutes to talk about TikTok. Some of you know the story. I'm just going to give you a brief overview. As the generalist I am, when I was at the station yesterday for the Hoof and Mouth, one of my fellow DJs asked me, "Hey, can you give me a little summary of what's happening with TikTok? Because I haven't been following the news, and maybe you could just give me a summary." And so I thought, maybe that would be a good tie-in to this show, since we're already talking about China and TikTok's in the news. So a little overview. So TikTok, and forgive me if I'm telling you some of the details you already know, but just to go from the top, TikTok is the social media app. It does these short videos. They can be a few seconds long. I think the longest can be a few minutes long, but they tend to be on the shorter side. And it's a very scaled down interface in that you just watch or swipe to indicate your interest in videos that you're seeing. And from your viewing habits or swiping habits, the app can infer the kinds of videos that you're most likely to stay engaged with. And so it starts sending you more of the videos that it thinks you'll like. And it's proven to be a devilishly effective algorithm in keeping people engaged, even to the point of addiction, of spending hours a day just watching TikTok video after TikTok video until the brain turns to mush, which is just great for the opportunities for monetization, like any social network. Because of TikTok's success, other social media services have cloned the short video format. You can find it on Instagram. You can find it on YouTube. They're like anything in social media, when anything seems to work in one company, they all quickly copy it. So TikTok has been a pioneer in new and improved ways of addicting people. And it's especially popular among young users, although not exclusively. There's people of all ages who use it, but middle school and high school Americans really, really seem to like TikTok. Well, the sticking point here is that TikTok is owned by a company called ByteDance, which has close connections to the Chinese Communist Party. ByteDance is a Chinese company. So TikTok is basically, it's the leading social network from China, in a way, from the Chinese Communist Party, that has a direct line into the eyeballs and brainstems of American youth. Again, not exclusively, I'm just talking generally here. And that has worried observers in the government for some time that that our chief adversary in the political, economic, and maybe even military arena has a direct communication line into millions and millions of American young people. And so there's a bill that just passed, actually, in the House of Representatives to ban TikTok, to ban it. And to be clear, that doesn't mean if it passes the Senate and Biden signs it, that doesn't mean that TikTok is going to just go up, poof, you know, in a puff of smoke. What it means is that TikTok would be put up for sale and some rich tech bro or conglomeration of tech bros would end up buying it. And that would open up a whole new can of worms. Who's buying it with what agenda? But gosh darn it, at least they'll be American, right? I think that's the idea. We're going to have Americans own TikTok and have the direct line into American teenagers. And so there's two main comments about TikTok. One is that the CCP manipulating young minds. And it's easy to make too big a deal out of this. I don't think there's a mind control ray coming out of Beijing. So I don't think we should spin out a crazy sci-fi scenario here. But I do think there is some concern. The Guardian covered a few years ago that TikTok was doing some CCP-friendly censorship from searches on Tiananmen Square and things like that. They claim that they've stopped, but I don't believe them. I'm sure they hold that option to continue that. So I think there is some legitimate concern about a foreign power having such direct access to so many impressionable Americans. On the other hand, I think the larger issue is the surveillance capability that TikTok has. They can track keystrokes, they can track location, they can track obviously interests and identity and build a dossier. And my goodness, who does that sound like? Intrusive surveillance from a social media app? Well, what do you know? It sounds exactly like American social media companies. And you don't hear Congress coming up with a national privacy bill to cut down on the unrestricted surveillance of American social media companies and their close partners, the data brokers that are constantly buying and selling people's private information without their knowledge or consent. These are American companies that are profiting off of their immoral and unethical surveillance of Americans. And so that's not part of this ban, and that's a real disappointment. So while I do want to acknowledge that I share some of the misgivings about TikTok being owned by a CCP-aligned company, I don't think we should discount that altogether. I think a clear and present danger that everyone should be aware of, and I think everyone should agree on, is that surveillance of American young people to this degree is wrong, and it is mostly carried out by American companies on Americans. And I wish Congress would do something about that. That's about all the time I have this evening. Maybe I'll get more into TikTok some other time. I'm going to be out next week, and I hope you will listen to guest host Lily Wen. She's going to have a great interview as far as I know, and I'm looking forward to hearing it. I am planning to be back in 2 weeks. And your homework between now and then, friends, is as follows. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google and keep listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Dave Mantle. And our outro this evening goes out to my brother from last night, Mr. Joe Magasco. Have a great 2 weeks, everybody.
Hey there, friends. We are back, that is, from the two-week-long on-air fundraiser that is the annual WFMU Marathon. And before I go any further, I want to thank everyone from the deepest recesses of my heart for your very generous donations. We had an incredible turnout money-wise, and we hit our goal. Before a few hours before the final bell went off last night, and we are very, very, very appreciative of your generous support to the whole station, and I am appreciative of your support for this show. And thanks again, really, really, you folks are the greatest, and you keep us, most important, you keep us listener supported. So thanks again, really. Traditionally, at least it's my tradition, after the marathon ends and there's so much talking, so much yakking. I mean, hopefully it's entertaining, but there's so much yakking that I try to keep it relatively quiet. Try to talk relatively little on the return show after the marathon. So I'm going to try to do that tonight. Meaning, I'm going to play a few long tracks. Unusual, I know. And a little bit less talking tonight and more wall-to-wall music, including an album side which I've really been wanting to play, and I'll get back to that I'll talk more about that and actually play it in a few minutes. But we're going to start the show with a track from a group called Birth, and this is, I just discovered them recently. It's a recent album. This is from a record released in 2022, a couple years ago, according to my calculations. And these guys are from San Diego, California. And when I first heard it, I didn't know who it was. I didn't know who the band was, and I didn't realize that it was such a recent release. And it's very easy to think that this is from, you know, 30, 40 years earlier. Heavy Moog synthesizer, Mellotron, and all the rest. So again, this is going to be a group called Birth, and this will be a track titled For Yesterday from an album called Born, appropriate album title, I guess. And be back after this.